Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few places in the war for the free world that are more momentous, I think it's fair to say, at this particular point in time, than the Western Pacific. And a man who has spent a lot of time thinking about our interests there as well as more broadly, particularly the importance of those waters to our economy as well as to our security, is our first guest. He is the former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy in the Reagan and Bush administrations. He also served as an assistant to my old boss, Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense at the time. He was a naval officer in his own right in 1985 to 2004. These days, we find him as the director of the Center for American Sea Power with the Hudson Institute. He is the author of numerous publications, but particularly of note are one that is a favorite of mine, Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy, and a book not yet published, it will be out in 2 weeks' time, entitled Sea Blindness. Seth Cropsey, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, I'd like to start, I guess, with that Western Pacific business. The South China Sea, as we've discussed in the past, Seth, has been increasingly declared by the Chinese to be a sort of inland water for them, a part of their territory. And they have been seizing, manufacturing, and fortifying islands all over it to try to ensure that they can actually back up those claims to the waters. Talk a little bit with us, if you would, particularly against the backdrop of rising tensions and dangers with respect to their proxies in North Korea, about those waters and our ability to project power in and through them.
Well, the most interesting thing that I've seen in the past week or so that connects North Korea with South China Sea is the North Korean ruler's threat to launch missiles in the vicinity of Guam. Guam is just the right distance, over 1,000 miles from Asian mainland, so that that threat must be delighting the Chinese, because that's exactly what China's policy in the region has been vis-a-vis the United States, which is the so-called anti-area denial, access denial, which is to say to make it impossible for or extremely difficult for the United States to project power into the region. So in that sense, what's going on right now is connected to China's longstanding policy of asserting, wrongfully, illegally asserting territorial sovereignty over the international waters of the South China Sea.
And it reminds us of how misbegotten has been, I think, successive administrations' conviction, which seems to be shared to some extent, at least by President Trump, that the Chinese will somehow dissuade the North Koreans from doing what the Chinese evidently see as advantageous to them and in their interest.
But yeah, that's right. But it seems as though, I mean, there was a couple of tweets from Trump, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, where he said that he was disappointed in the Chinese ruler's ability to rein in the North Koreans. It seems as though he gets it.
He seems to get it at some levels, and others, as we'll be talking about in the course of the show, it seems as though he's trying to also continue to cajole the Chinese into being helpful. Let me ask you about one other piece of this that I think is incredibly important, Seth Cropsey, and that is the extent to which we have built into the Navy's assets, an anti-missile capability that may be of exceptionally great importance in dealing with what the North Koreans are serving up at the moment. Could you talk a little bit about Aegis at Sea?
The Navy's been at work on this problem for well over 20 years. The Aegis system coordinates targeting information and information about, obviously, incoming missiles to provide solutions in the form of what is now the Standard Missile 3, with an advertised ability and proven ability to hit ballistic missiles. So the Navy has a role to play there. I think that there's an opportunity here that the United States has failed to exercise over the past 35 years or so since President Reagan said that we would defend against ballistic missiles, and that is to develop missiles that are capable of, that can hit ballistic missiles while they're close, and also while they're at a greater distance. And that's not, we don't have that yet. And our ballistic missile defense has been sporadic. And I think that the North Korean threats should be a ringing call to look back at this seriously and make the kind of sustained investments that would provide much better defense.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Particularly, I think our capacity to hit missiles in their boost phase, which would be ideal while they're over their own territory, the attackers, rather than elsewhere. Let me ask you, Seth, you've been writing recently about the Balkans. We've not been, many of us at least, paying much attention to that part of the world since, well, I guess the 1990s. But you're warning that the Russians may be moving in there, in at least sort of their now well-established form of sort of proxy warfare. This has a naval dimension to it as well, insofar as the Mediterranean, the Black Sea, and other littoral waters are all being increasingly populated by Russian vessels, it seems. Talk both about what's going on the land and in those waters that should be of concern to us, Seth Cropsey.
Well, in fact, Russia has supported the Serbs for a long, long time, going back to before World War One. Yugoslavia was the land of the southern Slavs. Putin sees an opportunity in the to break up the Dayton Accords, which have always been fragile at best, by appealing to the Serbs in Bosnia, the Bosnian Serbs. And at the same time that's happening, the Turks are supporting Albanian efforts, Albanians who live in Kosovo, who want to reunite with the motherland, with Albania, as well as, I mean, it's all very complicated, but as well as, because that's the Balkans, but as well as ethnic Albanians in Macedonia who would like to reunite with Albania. And there's increasing friendliness between the Turks and the Russians on this, because both of them see it as a way to sort of stick it to the West. Turkey falls into the category of what my colleague Walter Russell Mead calls, or maybe others as well, but I've seen Walter write it, NATO in name only. So it's an unholy partnership there between Moscow and Ankara.
And it's really sort of flipping matches into a powder keg on a good day, and the danger is not only to stick it to the West, but have very profound implications for the continent and our interests there as well. Seth, we're out of time, I'm afraid. We've got so much more to talk about. We didn't get to Iran sending a flotilla off into the Western Atlantic. That will be for another day. Perhaps the occasion of a prolonged discussion of Sea Blindness, your upcoming book, which we look forward to with great expectation. Thank you for the time today, though. Former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, Seth Cropsey, now with the Hudson Institute. It's great to talk with you as always, and I look forward to doing so again soon. Next up, we'll talk with Dan Gallington. We'll get his take on the Russia probe and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by an old friend and colleague, Daniel Gallington, an attorney by training, but a man who has spent most of his professional life in the uniform of the United States Air Force or in the civilian side of the various national security agencies. Like our previous guest, Seth Cropsey, he was also a special assistant to a Secretary of Defense, in this case, Donald Rumsfeld. He also acted as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict. I could go on and on. He's a man of many parts. He contributes these days mightily to the public policy debate with columns at the Washington Times. And, of course, with visits to us. We're always glad to have him. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Good. Well, you have been writing about an issue of great interest to many of us for a lot of different reasons, some nakedly partisan, some because we'd actually like to know what the truth is. But the whole truth, as they say, and nothing but the truth, about the Russia probe, about collusion with the Russians. Give us an update on what's happening with the investigation that the Trump team was engaged in such things and whether due attention is being given to whether others may have done so rather more fulsomely.
Right. I wrote a piece, as you know, on this subject. And the reason, the motive behind writing the piece was to remind people in the Washington area primarily about what prosecutors do, and that's that they prosecute. And too often we lose sight of that. And when you hear that they've convened a grand jury, as they have in this case, you also need to know that the grand jury is the prosecutor's best friend. The grand jury will tend to do anything the prosecutor wants them to do. So nobody should be surprised if there are indictments that come out of this grand jury, because that's what grand juries do.
And especially as it seems the focus of the investigation is ever growing. So wherever there's a prosecutional opportunity, they seem likely to be able to seize it.
Yes, and that's right into another point I wanted to make, and that is there's thousands of hours of investigators and interviews, and they interview hundreds of people. And typically, when they do that, they find violations of the law that have nothing to do with the reason for the basic investigation at all, but they find some technical violation, and then they use that as leverage to get a witness to turn or to testify in their favor. So look for that. That's going to happen, too.
We will, Dan. Let me ask you, the Nation magazine, not generally a source I cite, but in this case, I guess it's the broken clock story. Let me ask you, the Nation says that their forensic research has indicated that there was no hacking of the DNC servers by the Russians. I don't know how they could get access to those servers when the FBI couldn't, or at least didn't. But what do you make of that, Dan, that this may be actually a leak rather than something from the outside, and that no collusion was involved at all?
My answer might sound flippant, but it's not, and I know you'll know it's not, and that is I don't think that really matters at this stage. I think this investigation has, as we say, taken on life of its own. We're going to see collateral aspects of this investigation. And the thing that's most significant about it is all this talk about the memos, you know. Comey wrote memos when he talked to the president, and he came back to the FBI, and he briefed his people, and they wrote memos based on what Comey told him, that the president told him, and all that sort of thing. People need to understand that a memo written by an investigator after an interview is an extremely valuable tool in an investigation, and it's an opportunity to be creative, not that they did or would, but it is an opportunity to do that. And anytime you're reading a memo, you need to be especially suspect about the aggrandizement of the facts.
Hey, Dan, just another subject that I suspect we're not going to hear anything about from Mr. Mueller is the evidence of Democratic collusion with the Russians that certainly implicated the Clinton team, and one could argue President Obama as well. That would, I gather, be outside of bounds for this Mueller investigation?
Well, I don't think so. I think if he does, if he's politically astute, and he is, the guy's a very, very sharp Washington operator, and he finds and discovers something like that, in order to be perceived as balanced in his investigation, he'll look at that stuff. The news today was full of the fact that apparently the Obama administration knew long before the election that the Russians were fooling with our electoral system. And certainly some of the things that they did early in the Obama administration with the reset and all that sort of stuff had them looking the other way on things like that.
It is relevant indeed. Hey, Dan, let me take advantage of you quickly with respect to a lot of time you've spent in the intelligence realm, notably as the general counsel to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. We're hearing in connection with the Obama administration in its latter days a lot about Susan Rice and Samantha Power and John Brennan and Ben Rhodes and who knows who all else, engaging in a practice called unmasking of American citizens. What do you make of what you're hearing on that score, and what should the appropriate course of action be with respect to holding these folks accountable?
Well, my reaction to it when I heard about it was this obviously had been done for political purposes when you look at the timing of everything. And not only that, after the election in November, the Attorney General and the DNI issued new policies on unmasking and allowed essentially raw SIGINT information to go throughout the intelligence community without the traditional protections. The other thing that I think is remarkable is look at who was a big requester of unmasking, and that was the UN ambassador. Now, what in the hell does the UN ambassador have? What's the standing of that need to know about that? So, and oddly enough, having written back in my Justice Department days, having written most of those rules about when unmasking is appropriate, I find this practice to be to move into the total political realm. They basically wanted to know who the Russians, what Republicans the Russians were talking to, and then that was the reason for it.
Yeah. Well, we will be following these stories and much more. Dan, we didn't get to the piece that you wrote back in June about North Korea, but we're covering that intensively, and I look forward to having you back to visit about your insights into what is going on there and what should be done, particularly with respect to another subject you're expert on, missile defense, at a moment like this.
Remember, Frank, the thing that's most pertinent for the Korean thing is you and I both remember PD-59, and essentially when we targeted from the Carter administration, basically, when we targeted the Russian nomenklatura, the leadership, that really got their attention.
I think a kind of comprehensive program like Reagan used to bring down the Soviet Union ought to be done against the regime in North Korea. We have to leave it at that, though. Dan, thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again soon. Daniel Horowitz joins us next. We'll talk about his foreign policy critique and a backdoor amnesty. What's up with that? And more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by Daniel Horowitz, to my mind, one of the most impressive, relatively young thinkers, authors, commentators, pundits, and analysts of the circumstances in which we find ourselves at the moment. He is, of course, the author of a terrific must-read column at Conservative Review entitled The Conservative Consciousness with Daniel Horowitz. Daniel is also the author of a simply superb book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. You can also find his podcasts and videos and the like at Conservative Review. It is a pleasure always to have him with us, especially on a day when he has been thinking impressively about a couple of issues near and dear to our heart, including North Korea and a backdoor amnesty. So, Daniel, it's good to have you back as always. Welcome.
Great to be with you, Frank, in this busiest August in politics ever.
Well, it's my experience that Augusts typically are times when mischief is made, particularly by foreign adversaries of the United States, which brings us, of course, directly to North Korea. You've written a piece at Conservative Review under the headline, Stop Paying Ransom, How to Turn the Tables on North Korea. And it's an important piece in a number of respects, but I'd like you in particular to address how essential it is, as you see it, that we focus properly on the threat emanating from North Korea and not get distracted by some other challenges elsewhere around the world.
Sure. I think part of the problem is many Americans are war-weary because we've spent clearly two decades in the Middle East with many, many engagements. And there's really not a lot to show for it other than almost every theater deteriorating. That's why I think many Americans until now have really tuned out some of the existential threats to our country. Clearly, in those theaters, there's no threat directly to America in terms of a conventional military threat. There's no Navy, Air Force, or ICBMs that could hit us. Now we know in North Korea, they have ICBMs with miniaturized nuclear warheads that could likely hit the American mainland, certainly our assets in the Pacific. This was a direct threat. And that's why it is so important that Donald Trump jumped on this right away. You know, I've been a critic of some of his rhetoric in the past, pointing out that a lot of times his rhetoric doesn't really match his actions. But in this case, when it comes to North Korea, the first step to dealing with the problem is changing the posture. And I think that was really important to demonstrate to them that, no, we are done with the era of appeasement and paying your ransom, paying you off for leaving us alone. Actually, now we're going to put all options on the table.
It is important, it seems to me. We talked a little bit about this with Seth Cropsey earlier in the program, that we be putting assets in place if we are serious about this, if we want the North Koreans, and for that matter, the Chinese, to take us as a credible threat, not simply making more empty rhetorical challenges to the North Korean regime, to be putting in place, as I say, particularly naval assets capable of dealing with their missiles and other capabilities. As you look at it, is the president getting this right with respect to steering clear of some of these Islamic civil wars? I know that H.R. McMaster is pushing very hard for him to put ground forces in Afghanistan and in Syria, perhaps Iraq. How do you see it?
Sure. I mean, as you know, Frank, I mean, I've been a long advocate for dialing down not our engagement and our vigilance in the Middle East, but just these heavy-handed occupations that are so costly. And North Korea really brings this out because part of why China, North Korea, have been able to become so aggressive over the past decade or so is because they know we're so bogged down in the Middle East, and they know that, you know, A, we don't have the military capacity to deal with so many fronts, and also we don't have the political resolve to deal with it anymore because, again, we're so war-weary from these wasted engagements. And I think Trump is absolutely right, and now is the time to – it's a very pivotal moment because they're deciding what to do with Afghanistan, what to do with Syria, and I think he needs to weigh the need to have a very clear, robust deterrent against North Korea versus what are we going to gain out of getting involved in these five-way civil wars. And I think, you know, anyone who suggests that we, you know, send an extra 30,000 troops to Afghanistan and Syria, they need to answer how does that help our deterrent against North Korea, which, unlike those very impoverished countries, there is no threat directly from those countries. Now, to be clear, jihad is the consummate threat of our time. But again, that's a Muslim Brotherhood problem. That's a subversion problem. That's an immigration problem. Counterterrorism, intel. Certainly, we have to be very engaged. But in terms of the very heavy-handed military presence, I don't think it speaks to that challenge. And I think we need to preserve that for North Korea and Iran, which are the real threats.
I tend to agree with you, Daniel Horowitz. Let me ask you about another topic you've turned your attention to, including notably in your book, Stolen Sovereignty, and that is this question of immigration. I spoke yesterday with our mutual friend, Mark Krikorian, about the piece that you wrote about a backdoor amnesty that no one is talking about. Would you give us a read-in on what you're concerned about in connection with an action rhetoric disconnect with the Trump presidency in this domain as well?
Sure. So one of the biggest things that's quite obvious, but I guess it's not so obvious to many of Trump's supporters, is that he continued Obama's unconstitutional amnesty. I mean, this is the most unconstitutional thing you can imagine, to have a president unilaterally nullify our sovereignty, disregard immigration statutes, and just create an affirmative positive benefits for illegal immigrants, right? To give them work permits, social security cards. What's important to remember is that the year 2017 is a renewal year for this DACA program. It started in 2013. It gets renewed every 2 years. So Trump could have ended this, and he has a constitutional responsibility to end it, by a mere inaction. You just don't renew them, and it goes away. You don't even have to actively take away the status. And yet he's renewed hundreds of thousands of them, you know, pretty much at the same pace Obama was doing in 2016. That's number one. Number two is there's a lot of other backdoor half amnesty programs that a lot of people are unaware of. It's widely known we've brought in about 1 million immigrants, record numbers every year since the 90s. But those are just green cards. There's a number of other people that come here illegally, half illegally, meaning they'll come through our border, but they'll assert asylum, that they have a credible fear, which is a whole scam in itself. And, you know, pursuant to law, they should be placed in detention until their adjudication. And unless they're found to be here illegally or have a legal right to remain, they should be deported. Instead, what Obama did is he started granting them work permits. Wouldn't grant them green cards, but granted them work permits. And there's also a lot of other just visa categories that Obama created out of whole cloth. It just totally started giving them work permits. And again, these are things, you know, Trump complains about a lot of impediments to his presidency, the Senate Republicans and the filibuster and, you know, the other branches of government. Well, this is something he could just unilaterally shut off. Obama unilaterally created it, just stop continuing it. And all the data I show from USCIS seems to indicate that all of these programs are continuing, and this is just such an unforced error, you know, of continuing Obama's policies he promised to get rid of.
And what you've documented in this very important piece at Conservative Review is that the effect on illegal aliens believing that they can come to this country and benefit from doing so now seems to be turning the trend around from what initially had been taking place as a result of a concern on the part of many of them that life was going to get very tough for them under President Trump. This is an incredibly important point, and I know we'll need to come back to you to talk about it a bit further, hopefully in the very near future, Daniel Horowitz. But I think that trend and what it portends for us here in the United States is extraordinarily important. And an amnesty guised as a renewal, effectively, of DACA is deeply problematic, as you say. Thanks so much, Daniel, for joining us. As for all your work, I commend it to you all at Conservative Review, and most especially his book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Next up, we'll talk with Kevin Freeman about trade war with China. Turns out we're already in one. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to have with us, as we do each week, our friend and colleague Kevin Freeman, a man whose acumen about matters involving particularly economic warfare is unsurpassed, in my judgment, at least in our country at the moment, and I think probably on the planet for that matter as well. He is the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. You can find Kevin's writings at globaleconomicwarfare.com. He is also going to be starring shortly in a program offered by the Blaze television network each week entitled Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. I couldn't be more excited about that and to have him back. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Kevin, you've been writing about an issue now for some time involving Chinese economic warfare in the context of warnings that the United States might be precipitating a trade war with China. You've observed that, well, actually, we're already in one. Would you talk about the nature of that war as you see it at the moment and what the Trump administration is doing, if anything, materially to respond?
Well, it's just a simple fact. We've been in a trade war, or actually in a broader sense, an economic war with China since at least 1999, when they wrote, when the People's Liberation Army published a book titled Unrestricted Warfare. I mean, it basically outlined, we don't want to get into a direct shooting conflict with the United States, but we can undermine them and we can literally overtake them if we use these following policies, trade being a big part of it. So we're already in an economic war. We've been for some time. What's interesting, though, is that when President Trump talks about the idea of stopping Chinese infiltration and theft of our intellectual property, all of a sudden they say, oh, he's threatening a trade war. Wait a minute. They've been stealing us blind, probably to the tune of $300 billion more per year. Our economy is substantially smaller because of how China has operated. And so when President Trump says we're going to investigate this, all of a sudden there's calls, oh, no, he's calling for a trade war.
You've also warned, Kevin, that in addition to predatory trade practices whereby, for example, if American companies, say Apple, want to do business in China, they have to turn over the seed corn of their intellectual property, of their technology. But there's also another problem which you've identified at globaleconomicwarfare.com, and that is the Chinese buying up companies here in this country, notably in Silicon Valley, but elsewhere as well, and simply taking full ownership of their technology and thereby, you know, further eroding our competitiveness. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. And just to give you an idea, I visited Shenzhen, one of the television manufacturing companies, original equipment manufacturers, as an investment manager, and back in 1999, and their flat panel display TVs were a big deal then. They weren't really prominent, and Americans had invented them, and the Chinese were developing, producing them either components or in whole. And what happened was they told us flat out, as soon as we've mastered this, we will be producing our own, and they'll be better than any American or European televisions because we'll integrate the best of both worlds. Well, that's complete theft. That's an example. Another example is Apple comes in. You mentioned it. Apple comes in and says, we want to sell in your large and growing market. And China says, sure, you show us exactly how secure your devices are by telling us exactly how they work. That's an opportunity to steal the intellectual property.
As well as to exploit the vulnerabilities in those security systems for intelligence and other purposes.
Great point. Exactly right. And as you mentioned, in Silicon Valley, they're taking money that we gave them in the IPO, the initial public offering of Alibaba, and they have then been using that cash to buy up American companies, which normally would be fine, except for the fact that the American owner of shares of Alibaba has nothing other than a piece of paper. He has no protections, no investor rights, no anything. They just essentially got our money, and if they're kind enough to us, they will give us a piece of it back.
And in addition to that, the other problem, of course, is we've talked about going back to the arguments against that transaction in the first place, Kevin Freeman, was the Alibaba operation is very much part of the Chinese Communist Party, People's Liberation, operation. And it will, in fact, mean that these technologies are migrating into the hands of people who wish us ill.
A perfect example, Huawei Technologies, which is founded by a former PLA member, has now integrated a lot of the best technologies from around the world and now has become the top smartphone, which means that there's a backdoor for the Chinese military to watch, monitor, whatever, through those kind of components are no longer allowed in the Pentagon.
Kevin, another piece of economic warfare that worries me particularly is the likelihood that the Chinese will use their monopoly of rare earth minerals to penalize us if we, in fact, start waging economic warfare back at them. How serious a problem do you think that represents, and what can be done to mitigate it?
Well, that's not just conjecture that's, among the elite national security people like yourself. It is something that was actually, John Moody wrote a Fox News opinion piece on this yesterday, Trump's game of chicken. Yeah. So it's absolute that they have control of the rare earth minerals. It's part of their strategy. They took control by discouraging other countries from developing them, buying up mines wherever they could. These are really rare minerals that are necessary to make all sorts of things, from lithium batteries to the chips that we used. We're dependent on them, and China has successfully created a monopoly of them. And if they want to fight back, all they have to do is look at what OPEC did in the 1970s and realize this is a potent economic weapon.
Yeah, well, worse than that, as you know, Kevin Freeman, they have actually used this weapon against the Japanese when they found themselves cross with them some years ago. It's a potent weapon, and it's one that they have wielded. So I think you're absolutely right. Going back to the 1999 blueprint, expect these kinds of warfare operations from the Chinese in the future. Let me ask you about one other piece of the North Korean threat. We've been talking about it throughout the program, Kevin. I'd be interested in your analysis of the electromagnetic pulse dimension of that threat. Is it real? If so, how seriously should we be about the business of protecting ourselves against it?
Well, I'm by no means an electrical engineer or physicist, but I have studied this in detail. I put it included in my book, Game Plan. I've looked at it. This is an absolutely genuine threat. We know that power grids are susceptible to large surges of energy, whether they come from a coronal mass ejection. The sun sends out a solar flare, and that energy wipes out a power grid. We've seen that happen. Or we know it from the experiments that they had, nuclear high-altitude nuclear testing they did in the Pacific, where they were wiping out power grids and islands below them. It's absolutely a threat. It's real. We have means to mitigate it, but we haven't shown the political will to do so. And the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, the North Koreans have all at various points mentioned that that's a vulnerability we have that they're aware of. And now with a miniaturized nuclear weapon and missile capabilities, ICBM capabilities that the North Koreans have. They absolutely, they've created and developed a perfect EMP weapon, and we should be mitigating against it, but we're not.
Yeah, urgently needed corrective action, both at the federal level and I think in places like your home state of Texas. I wish we had more to show for the efforts we've been making with the Secure the Grid Coalition to that end, but we appreciate your clarion calls on this and look forward to your help in bringing it to the attention of a larger audience, Kevin Freeman, through your new television program at the Blaze TV, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Come back to us next week. Kevin, thank you so much for your time today. God bless you. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.